United States Court of Appeals for the 11th Circuit. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The United States Court of Appeals for the 11th Circuit is now open according to law. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Good morning, everyone. The first case we have on the calendar today is United States of America versus Javier Estepa and Diego Alejandro Estepa Vasquez. Are counsel ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor.
Mr. Klug, would you like to say 5 minutes for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor, thank you.
All right, you may proceed, thank you.
This case involves a construction bid contract in which the county was the party, Miami-Dade County was the party that wanted the construction work performed. Because they received federal funds, they were obligated to enforce the Davis-Bacon requirements in any federally funded construction project. The bid proposal by my client's company, Aaron Construction, represented that it would comply with all of the very, very lengthy set of requirements that were part of the sort of as a form part of the contract bidding process. In fact, the number of requirements, technical and governmental regulatory compliant requirements, really amounts to thousands of words in this contract. Some of those words deal with Davis-Bacon compliance, because the county has a dual role. It has a role in wanting the construction work to be done, and it also is a delegated something on the order of an agency role, where it's taking on the federal government's enforcement of the Davis-Bacon requirements. It follows up on the construction in these projects to make sure that forms are filed that comply with Davis-Bacon requirements, which have to do with the rate of pay for construction workers. The court has dealt with allegations of bid fraud in the past, but it is never in this context held that where the financial components, where the hat that the county is wearing with regard to its financial components and its financial obligations to its citizens, where those, there's no fraud in relation to that, no fraud in relation to the representations with regard to the quality of work, and where we're not dealing with a special charity set aside or anything of that kind, that where we're just dealing with low bidder provides the best value for the taxpayer, that in that context, no prosecution for fraud has been found to be valid in this court. And the analogy that we argue here is that it much like in construction and carpentry, the rule is the right tool for the right job. And the right tool in this case, as was used in the Bazantes case, Bazantes, that the government cited and we have also responded to, is the false statements. It relates to the enforcement application aspect of the case. In Bazantes, the defendants are in a similar position. The government charges only the false statements made in terms of claiming that they're compliant with Davis-Bacon. And the court finds that those false statements are certainly material to that enforcement component. The problem with expanding it beyond the existing limited categories in which bid contracts have been held to be fraud is that it really has no bound with regard to enforcement, because as you could see from the very exhibits that the government cites in terms of what the defendants agreed to do in this case, the number of things that the defendants have to agree to do, they have to agree to be compliant with every possible law in their and everything that they're doing. Those related to this particular aspect that they're dealing with a governmental entity that is again wearing these two hats, one of which is an enforcement hat. The law with regard to fraud has really created this sharp categorical divide between interference with enforcement, interference with license issuance, interference with other governmental functions, and things that affect the financial value.
Mr. Clue, may I ask you a question? Because I'm not sure I understand the argument. Is it your view that if a contractor participates in a scheme knowingly to falsify the forms as to Davis-Bacon, as to who worked, how many hours, et cetera, just falsified, intentionally falsified the forms, that would not be enough to state a claim for wire or mail fraud, assuming the wires or mails were used to affect that scheme? That there has to be something more than simply falsifying the forms as to who worked, how much they worked, and what they were paid?
Yes, because again, with regard to these forms and that aspect of the contract, the county is operating in a different role. We're charged with defrauding the county. The county's interest as a county in terms of this transaction, its financial interest in this transaction, is getting the work done in a manner that saves the taxpayers the most money. To the extent these other activities, they engage in other enforcement activities with regard to make sure that your list of employees, you show that they're getting a specific rate. That is really something unrelated to its financial interest in the transaction.
Let me stop you on that if I could for a second and just help me. Wouldn't the county face a severe risk of the loss of money if the federal government knew that the forms were false and were knowingly false as to Davis-Bacon? Wouldn't they run the powerful risk that Uncle Sam would say, well, we're simply not giving you any more money for these low-income housing projects because we want to enforce Davis-Bacon, and it hasn't been enforced here because you've allowed a knowing falsity to be made about who worked, how much they worked, and what they were paid?
Your Honor, there's a theoretical risk that if the county did something wrong, that the federal government would take some kind of action. But that is again part of the generalized interest in the county in seeing that they are complying and that they are insisting on compliance with the law.
Doesn't the federal government expect and require the county to implement a regime so that they could ensure that Davis-Bacon was complied with? Isn't that obligation placed squarely on the county by the Department of Housing and Urban Development?
Yes. The obligation is, again, this enforcement of Davis-Bacon. And Davis-Bacon, I think it's been around for 90 years. And I don't know of any prosecution ever for fraud, for violation of Davis-Bacon.
I was under the impression that we addressed this specific question in Maxwell. Why does not Maxwell foreclose your argument?
Maxwell is an important case to distinguish. I know the government did not cite it, and I don't know to the extent they're relying on it, but Maxwell is where you have a set-aside contract. Set-aside is the same as in functionally the same as a charity contract, where the purpose of the money, there's a financial purpose of the money. The purpose of the transaction is to make sure that certain types of individuals get the money. There was no allegation, and there's certainly no testimony that was any form of the purpose here. The purpose here was solely to get the work done. The government, federal government, has its own interest and forces the county to assume its regulatory responsibility. And these actions, they interfere with that regulatory responsibility, but they're highly distinguishable from Maxwell because you don't have the interest of a financial component of the transaction being that certain people will get the money. In this case, for example, there was no requirement that any employees be used. Mr. Estepa could have gone in there and done all the work himself. and not have to file any Davis-Bacon requirements. There was no intention, oh, we have to have employees getting money in this transaction. So no set aside like Maxwell. This is simply, the government forces us, the federal government forces us to engage in these compliance mechanisms. And when people don't comply, as we've said, they impose fines and they do anything.
The difficulty, just to follow up if I could, on Judge Anderson's question is, in Maxwell, we explained that a financial loss is not at the core of these mail and wire frauds. Instead, the penal statutes also seek to punish the intent to obtain money or property from a victim by means of fraud and deceit. So the problem there wasn't the financial loss, but a material falsity having been propagated. How do we get around that here? Maybe I think I've missed the distinction you would have us draw.
The distinction is that if we don't cabin the fraud having to do something to do with what is the financially material part of the transaction, then fraud will have no limit. Then everybody, in any context, and I could go vastly into all kinds of explanations. Although I think the one I used in my brief is that the defendant promises not to engage in speeding to and from the job site. And that becomes fraud because he's a habitual speeder. Anything that goes beyond what is financially relevant to the contract. And what was financially relevant to the contract in whether there's loss or not, what was financially relevant, there's loss in charity. There's no loss in charity either. The county gives away the money. But if you claim to be a charity and you're not a charity, you've defrauded the county because they wanted money to go to a charity.
Let me ask the question in a slightly different way. If a general contractor, and I'm not talking about the facts here, I'm just asking more generally, if a general contractor knowingly violates Davis-Bacon by falsifying who works, the hours worked, and the hours actually paid, the amounts actually paid, that would not state a crime?
It does for false statement. And then that's what this court, that's what everybody has always been prosecuted for before this. And again, that has to, it because these statutes, as the court knows, they just expand and expand and expand. And people say, well, it's not enough that we charge 15,001 statement, false statement prosecutions. We need to add a fraud prosecution, even though, as the court admits, there's clearly no loss. In fact, there's a gain. The irony in this case is if we compare Supreme Court's discussion in Pasquantino, for example, where they say defrauding a government of tax money is fraud. In this case, the government is saying saving the taxpayers' money is fraud if you're violating a regulation that the government imposed, that the federal government imposes. And that contradiction is, I think, at the heart of the issue.
You, just to follow up on this, acknowledged a moment ago that when I asked you the question whether the county ran a real and substantial risk that the federal government would stop financing these projects in Dade County if they knew that Davis-Bacon was being knowingly and pervasively violated, you said, well, that could be a theoretical risk to the county, but that's not enough. Can you explain why that would just be a theoretical risk stated at a high order of abstraction?
Well, from an evidentiary standpoint, I think that theory and practice are important in a criminal case, first of all. That's my first answer. My second answer is, and I knew I wasn't being fully clear about what I was saying. I don't believe that there's any risk. And I think that it's clear in the law, there's no risk as long as the county is not doing something wrong. The county hires people because there's Davis-Bacon violations all over the place all the time. In federal government, there's zero actual risk if the evidence had come in. That as long as the county is not knowingly involved in some kind of corruption, then the county's not at risk at all.
So the county could bury its head in the sand, not enforce Davis-Bacon at all. And as long as the contract was performed, the work was done well, that would be the end of it.
I would argue that if they were being deliberately ignorant, if the county is doing anything wrong, including deliberate ignorance, there would possibly be, again, theoretically, because there's no evidence of anything to that effect in this case, and that was not the theory that was used in this case. So that was not something we had to address factually. But I don't think it is the case that absent complicity by the county in some violation of the federal law, that there was any risk whatsoever.
I've got it. Thank you very much.
Council, we let you go over your time, but we'll give you additional time for rebuttal. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Wu, are you ready?
Thank you. Yes. Good morning. May it please the court. Jason Wu on behalf of the United States. Sometimes, Your Honors, the way things appear to be is exactly what they are. Despite the Estepa's insistence to the contrary, what they did constituted fraud. And the reason it was fraud is because they procured millions of dollars in government
panel,
contracts.
We lost Mr. Clue again.
Uh-oh. Okay. Oh, there he is.
Okay. He's back.
So the reason this constituted fraud was because the Estepas procured millions of dollars in government contracts through material misrepresentations about how they intended to perform on those contracts. So I'd like to try to conceptualize my opponent's argument in a few different ways today to explain that any way you slice it, their argument fails. The first way we can think about it is they may be arguing that fraud requires that the scheme be designed to cause the victim a financial loss or monetary loss. As Judges Anderson and Marcus have pointed out this morning, that's not required under the fraud statutes, which is exactly what this court said in Maxwell. In fact, Maxwell was a nearly indistinguishable case, government contracting case, where the argument made by the defendant on appeal was that ultimately there was no fraud because the county received the electrical work that it had sought. And as Judge Marcus quoted, this court stated that the financial loss is not at the core of these mail and wire fraud statutes. The second way we could think about this way to conceptualize their argument is that they may be saying that this is not a fraud scheme because the misrepresentations did not go to or impact the nature of the bargain that the county was entering. However, there are ways that non-financial terms can affect someone's assessment of the bargain. And this court has said so in its past fraud cases, which is that frauds can either be affected by a representation regarding the price of a good or service, that's a financial misrepresentation, or it can be based on a misrepresentation about the characteristics of the good or service. This is a quintessential example of the latter category. The Estepas misrepresented the way that they were going to perform these government contracts and lied about their intent to skirt federal labor law. And as Judge Marcus pointed out, that exposes the county to a risk not only of losing federal money, but of having to go through the process of obtaining new contractors if the Estepas contract was canceled. I'd also like to point out, it's wrong to say that the Estepas misrepresentations about Davis-Bacon had no impact on the county's financial assessment of this transaction. The way these contracts worked was that the county set an expected price for the total service. And then the bidders tried to come in under that. So for instance, the county said $900,000 for a year's worth of maintenance, and the Estepas offered $747,000. The county calculated that expected cost of service based on the assumption that all the contractors were using Davis-Bacon wages. And as an example, Francisco Trujillo, one of the trial witnesses, explained every single line item in that contract is calculated based on the cost of materials and the expected cost of labor. So at docket entry 254, pages 11 to 12, he gave the example of a toilet. He said, we know a toilet, how much it costs at Home Depot. We have an expectation of how many hours it would take to replace it. And so we multiply that by the wage that we expect to pay, add a little overhead and profit, and that's the amount that we charge that component under the contract. So again, if the county knew that its vendors were not following Davis-Bacon and were paying lower wages, it would have lowered all those amounts in the contract and would have announced a different expected cost for the total maintenance contract. So it did affect the financial aspect of the transaction. That's a critical fact. The third and final way we could conceive of the argument this morning is that it's really an attack on materiality. It boils down to saying that these lies did not matter to the county. And the problem for the defendants on that front is that every witness from the county who testified at trial said that Davis-Bacon compliance was important to them and that it would have affected their assessment of the Estepa's performance if they had known about their scheme. That included even their four defense witnesses who testified from the county. In closing, I'll respond briefly to a few points from Mr. Clue. Mr. Clue suggested that there is no bounds for regards to enforcement of the fraud statutes if you endorse the theory pursued in this case. But the obvious bound here is materiality. Not every lie or misrepresentation is going to be material. So in his example of violating the jaywalking laws or the speeding laws, I sincerely doubt that the county witnesses would have testified that they would have canceled the Estepa's contract if they found out that the Estepa's jaywalked to the job site on one random Saturday. And it's evident in the contracts themselves, which on their front page, the very first page of the request for a bid, states that the contracts require Davis-Bacon compliance. They do not state that the contracts require jaywalking compliance or speeding compliance. So with that in mind, if the panel has no further questions, we respectfully request that you affirm the Estepa's conviction.
I have one, Mr. Wu. Part of the argument that had been made by both lawyers in this case was that the evidence was insufficient on its own steam, that the defendants did not have the requisite intent to commit fraud, holding aside the first argument that Mr. Clue has raised. I read the briefs as having said, in any event, the government had a failure of proof about the mens rea in this case. Ought we to consider in the mix of that the fact that one of the defendants actually testified? Isn't that evidence, substantive evidence, that goes into the mix of considering the aggregation of proofs presented?
Yes, Your Honor, at least as to Diego Estepa.
I'm just talking about as to Mr. Diego Estepa. It would not affect the other defendant in this case. You could hardly impute an allegedly false exculpatory statement made on the witness stand by one defendant against the other unless you somehow could tie it into a continuing conspiracy. And you don't have anything like that in this case. I'm simply asking whether that isn't part of the body of proof that we would have to look at. I only raise it because you did not make reference to that particular item as part of the aggregation of evidence. Maybe I missed it.
I did very briefly, Your Honor. So in a footnote, so I actually have a more fundamental point as to Diego Estepa's sufficiency challenge, which is that it cannot be adopted merely from an opponent's or from a co-defendant's co-appellant's brief. And in the footnote where I make that argument, citing the Corey case, I also mention in any event, Diego Estepa's challenge would have to fail because he testified under Brown, his testimony could be used against him.
Thank you.
If there are no further questions, I thank you for your time, and we respectfully request that you affirm the convictions.
Thank you, Mr. Wu. Mr. Clue, you have 5 minutes remaining for rebuttal. You have to unmute yourself.
Sorry.
Thank you. That's okay.
The focus, I as Judge Marcus stated, and as I believe Judge Marcus stated in the en banc case in Civetti, in a fraud case, is on the defendant's intent and whether the defendant is trying to financially cheat the other party. And I think that is really possibly the strongest point for us here, because the intention of the defendant is manifested by what they did in terms of the financial components of the transaction. There are other examples that you can use in this context, but one of them, which is suppose that the county is trying to collect coins from juveniles. And so it offers $1 for every 4 quarters a minor brings in. And an 18-year-old brings in 4 quarters. And gets a dollar bill. Under the government's theory, because there was money involved, because he falsely represented he was a minor, there would be a fraud. but there is clearly no financial fraud intention. There's an intention to interfere with a government function, but there's not an intention to commit a financial fraud. The government refers to failure of an intention to perform, but performance under the contract was separate from an agreement to comply with general law, law that's been on the books forever. And while someone should or could and should be prosecuted for any false statement that interferes with the government function, or could even be charged with a 371 conspiracy in that regard. But those frauds, those interferences under McNally have been very clearly separated from frauds that where somebody is trying to hurt somebody financially, somebody's trying to cheat somebody financially.
Council, may I ask you a question? And I know this, but did your clients have to certify when they were awarded the bids that they certified that they would comply with the Davis-Bacon Act?
They certified on the contract that included the Davis-Bacon Act requirement. There was a long, very long list. I think the government exhibit 13A is an example. Very, very long, thousands of words. And one of part of it is the includes Davis-Bacon, because it's all the compliance adhesion component of this.
But for the certification, they wouldn't have been awarded the contract, correct?
That's true. The government relies on the causation, the transaction, the contractual transaction causation theory. But we urge the court to reiterate that causing a party to engage in a transaction, the party would not have engaged but for a misstatement, is not the same as intending to financially cheat the other party. And that is the risk. The great risk of fraud is that because money seems to be involved in just about everything, then including even in licensing, which the court in Schatz and has said is not a financial fraud, that there has to be a distinction between false statements that go to a general enforcement aspect of a governmental function, interference with a governmental function, and things that are intended to cheat another party out of money. The government's reference to harm to bidders, I think the courts, I had not heard that argument before. Other bidders would have come in with set their bids at higher rate. I know the Third Circuit has directly held that you cannot base financial fraud prosecution on the theory that other bidders were defrauded, other bidders were bid too high because you were taking advantage of a non-compliance with the request. I believe this court, and again, it's important, the government treats this as if it's an open and shut case. The court has never gone this far before. And I don't know of any other court that has gone this far before. The government certainly didn't cite one. And it's so important because this statute, as the Supreme Court has repeatedly held, time after time after time, is the one that the government pushes and pushes and pushes that pushes too far. There are no further questions.
Thank you very much, Mr. Clu. Thank you very much, Mr. Wu. And thank you, Ms. Stage, for being here today. We will take care of the matter under advisement. Thank you very much. Have a good day, all of you. Thank you.